Welcome to 30 Minutes of VOA Learning English, the voice of America's information service for people learning English. Join us now for our daily magazine show, As It Is, and other programs designed for English learners.
A human rights group has strong words for Afghanistan's leaders.
From the 50 cases that we have investigated, only in one case there was prosecution and investigation.
Nigerian voters choose a former military dictator as their new president.
He has the experience. He knows the problem of the country more than any other person.
I'm Christopher Jones Cruz at the Voice of America in Washington. Jonathan Evans and Jim Tedder will bring you those stories today. Then, in his weekly technology report, Jonathan will tell us how smartphones are being used to test people for sexually transmitted diseases.
Healthcare workers can send the test results to a wireless information storage system to give doctors easy access to the disease diagnoses.
And later, we bring you our regular weekday series, The Making of a Nation. Today, we will look at American society in the 1920s. It was changing in many important ways.
Some Americans became afraid of these millions of people arriving at their shores.
And finally today, in our American Moments series, we look back at April 20th, 1999. That was the day two teenaged boys, armed with guns and bombs, killed 12 of their fellow students and a teacher. This is As It Is, a daily 30-minute program from VOA Learning English. Every day, we bring you news from and about America and the world. And we tell you the often surprising and always interesting history of the United States. We're on the radio, on the web, and we come to you on a podcast. We are wherever you are. We're the Voice of America. A well-known human rights group is urging Afghanistan's leaders to protect defenders of women's rights in the country. As Jonathan Evans reports, Amnesty International is claiming that the government has not acted to stop increasing levels of violence and sexual attacks, and even plots to kill women's rights activists.
The report says both the government and the international community are turning their backs on Afghan women activists, leaving them vulnerable. It says these activists have bravely fought for the gains Afghanistan has made toward improving human rights conditions. Researchers say the Taliban are to blame for the majority of attacks against the defenders of women's rights. They note that government officials and powerful local commanders are increasingly linked to violence against women. The report says those threatened include rights activists, politicians, lawyers, journalists, and teachers. It says even women in the police force have faced threats of violence. Amnesty International's Afghanistan researcher, Horia Mossadegh, spoke with VOA. She says the group spoke with more than 50 defenders of women's rights and their family members. Those questioned said that officials often ignored or refused to take threats against women seriously.
From the 50 cases that we have investigated, only in one case there was prosecution and investigation. This shows, first, the failure of the Afghan government for not protecting women human rights defenders, and second, the failure of the judiciary and other law enforcement officials for not being able to protect women or to investigate the cases or to bring the perpetrators into justice.
The report says that since 2001, the international community has spent hundreds of millions of dollars on projects in support of Afghan women's rights. But Amnesty International says more needs to be done. Many women defenders who reported violence or attacks are put in danger and face criticism or threats for speaking out. Horia Mossadegh says Amnesty International officials have held many meetings with President Ashraf Ghani, Chief Executive Abdullah Abdullah, and other Afghan officials. She says those meetings were designed to bring to their attention the problems facing women's rights activists. She says the officials have yet to take actual steps to end the threats. Horia Mossadegh says she fears female activists are likely to face increased violence in the months to come. The reasons? Plans to withdraw international forces from Afghanistan, increasing Taliban attacks, and the rise of the Islamic State in the country.
These are all, unfortunately, not good signals for the future of Afghanistan, and more particularly for the protection of women human rights defenders. And we are quite concerned that if concrete steps are not taken, the situation may get worse in the coming months or years.
She says a legal method to protect women in Afghanistan is in place. But she says a failure to carry out and enforce these rules has turned them into empty promises. I'm Jonathan Evans.
You are listening to As It Is from The Voice of America. Nigerians chose a former dictator as their next president in national elections last month. 72-year-old Muhammadu Buhari is a retired general and former military leader of the country. Today, he says he is a born-again Democrat. But those who remember his strict military regime wonder if he is really a changed man. In 1983, Mr. Buhari took power in a military coup and ruled Nigeria for 20 months. He ran unsuccessfully for president 3 times before defeating Goodluck Jonathan last month. His victory was the first time in Nigeria that a candidate has defeated a sitting president in an election. Jim Tedder tells us more now about what lies ahead for the man who will govern one of Africa's most populous nations.
Many people are calling Mr. Buhari's victory a political turning point and a major step forward for democracy in Nigeria. But some people, such as artist Femi Kuti, are asking why the world is celebrating a former military dictator.
Do I believe he's a changed man? I don't think so. And then if he's a changed man, is his surroundings, the people in his political party, are they changed? Can he convince them to change? Can he convince them not to be corrupt? I don't believe so. But then, I don't want to be pessimistic.
Femi Kuti is the son of singer and Afrobeat legend Fela Kuti. 30 years ago, a military court under then-dictator Muhammadu Buhari sentenced Fela Kuti to 5 years in prison. Human rights group Amnesty International declared the singer a political detainee and campaigned for his release. His son remembers the event well. He says his father was falsely charged.
It was horrific. It was terroristic. It was depressing. Let's take for instance the story of my father, who was arrested for taking £1,600, and he declared it, and he was charged and jailed. I witnessed the beatings and the trauma and all what my father went through.
Mr. Buhari has taken full responsibility for his actions during his time in power. He has apologized to political opponents. In a speech, he called himself a reformed or changed Democrat. Political analyst Shita Inwazi says he does see a difference between Mr. Buhari now and then.
Some of the language that has been coming from him this time around is not as firm as it used to be back in the day. In the previous three elections, there was this sort of air of it's my way or the highway. It's kind of like the last 4 years have actually taught him that democracy, you don't achieve your results by giving orders, but by compromise.
During his time in power in the 1980s, Mr. Buhari declared what he called a war on indiscipline. Political opponents and critics of his regime were jailed. He introduced plans to end corruption, fought against drug trafficking, and forced citizens to form neat lines at bus stops. His laws restricting press freedom were the worst in the country's history. Today, journalist Al-Qasim Abdul Qadir says Mr. Buhari is a reformed leader who is ready to work with other countries, political parties, and ethnic groups.
Only a Democrat will talk about international cooperation within African states, with Western powers. We'll talk about how collectively to tackle the insurgency, how to collectively tackle corruption, because these are ills that can only be tackled in a very cooperative manner.
Mr. Buhari has promised to improve the situation in Nigeria. He says he will deal with corruption and inequality between rich and poor, and he says he will improve security in the country's northeast. There, the Islamist militant group Boko Haram leads an increasingly violent rebellion. Umar Dalla is a retired police officer from the country's northeast. He says the rise of the Boko Haram militant group is a symbol of the former government's failure. Mr. Dalla strongly believes Mr. Buhari is the best leader for Nigeria.
He has the experience. He knows the problem of the country more than any other person.
The recent election sends a strong message to Mr. Buhari, too. If he fails, the voters will remove him from office. I'm Jim Tedder.
Jonathan Evans is back now with his weekly report on the latest technology news. This week, he tells us about new ways researchers are using to diagnose sexually transmitted diseases like syphilis and HIV, the virus that causes AIDS. Poor patients living in rural areas are much less likely to be able to receive costly tests for these diseases. So researchers have developed a mobile phone device that may make the tests less costly and more available. Jonathan tells us now the researchers say the device tells healthcare workers within 15 minutes whether someone is infected with HIV or syphilis.
Scientists at Columbia University in New York developed the small electronic device to attach to any smartphone. Biomedical engineer Sam Sia is one of the developers of the device, called a dongle. He says the dongle detects the biological markers for both HIV and syphilis and shows the results on the smartphone. Mr. Sia adds that early diagnosis may be a matter of life and death to patients such as pregnant women in rural parts of Africa. Healthcare workers can send the test results to a wireless information storage system to give doctors easy access to the disease diagnoses. Immediate treatment of HIV and syphilis can stop the spread of the potentially deadly illnesses. All of the chemicals used for testing are in small plastic containers that can be used only one time. The device analyzes blood taken from a small cut on the finger. The dongle was tested on 96 pregnant women in Rwanda. The women were at high risk of passing HIV and syphilis onto their babies. The results of the test were highly accurate. The dongle costs about $34. Each test container is about $1.50. This is far less than the $18,000 cost for the equipment needed to do a similar blood test in a laboratory. It took 30 minutes to train Rwandan healthcare workers how to use the device. Sam Sia says the dongle makes the smartphone test especially useful in developing countries. He says that healthcare workers can use the test in a clinic or in rural areas where patients live. He adds that the dongles could also be used to test for diseases such as hepatitis, herpes, and malaria. Mr. Sia and his research team are preparing for a larger test of the device that the World Health Organization requires for approval. I'm Jonathan Evans.
Thanks, Jonathan. Now, time for our daily The Making of a Nation program. Americans experimented with many new customs and social traditions during the 1920s. There were new dances, new kinds of clothes, and some of the most imaginative art and writing ever produced in the United States. But in most ways, the 1920s were a conservative time in American life. Voters elected three conservative Republican presidents, Warren Harding, Calvin Coolidge, and Herbert Hoover. And they supported many conservative social and political policies. This week in our series, Kay Gallant and Harry Monroe continue the story of American conservatism during the 1920s.
One such policy concerned immigration. Most Americans in the 1920s had at least some ties through blood or marriage to the first Americans who came from Britain. Many people with these kinds of historic ties considered themselves to be real Americans, true Americans. Americans traditionally had welcomed newcomers from such Western European countries as Britain, France, or Germany. But most of the people arriving in New York City and other harbors in the 1920s were from the central, eastern, and southern areas of Europe. Some Americans became afraid of these millions of people arriving at their shores. They worried that the immigrant newcomers might steal their jobs, or they feared the political beliefs of the immigrants.
Pressure to control immigration increased following the World War. Congress passed a bill that set a limit on how many people would be allowed to enter from each foreign country. And the Congress and President Calvin Coolidge agreed to an even stronger immigration law in 1924. Under the new law, limits on the number of immigrants from each foreign country depended on the number of Americans who had families in that country. For example, the law allowed many immigrants to enter from Britain or France because many American citizens had families in those countries. but fewer people could come from Italy or Russia because fewer Americans had family members in those countries. The laws were very difficult to enforce, but they did succeed in limiting the number of immigrants from certain countries.
A second sign of the conservative feelings in the 1920s was the nation's effort to ban the sale of alcoholic drinks or liquor. This policy was known as prohibition because it prohibited or banned alcoholic drinks. Many of the strongest supporters of prohibition were conservative Americans living in rural areas. Many of them believed that liquor was evil, the product of the devil. A number of towns and states passed laws banning alcohol sales during the first years of the 20th century. And in 1919, the nation passed the 18th Amendment to the Federal Constitution. This amendment and the Volstead Act made it unlawful to make, sell, or transport liquor.
Prohibition laws failed terribly from the start. There was only a small force of police to enforce the new laws, and millions of Americans still wanted to drink liquor. It was not possible for the police to watch every American who wanted to buy a drink secretly or make liquor in his own home. Not surprisingly, thousands of Americans soon saw a chance to make profits from the new laws. They began to import liquor illegally to sell for high prices. Criminals began to bring liquor across the long unprotected border with Canada, or on fast boats from the Caribbean islands. At the same time, private manufacturers in both cities and rural areas began to produce liquor, and shop owners in cities across the country sold liquor with little interference from local police. By the middle of the 1920s, it was clear to most Americans that prohibition laws were a failure. But the laws were not changed until the election of President Franklin Roosevelt in 1932.
A third sign of conservatism in the 1920s was the effort by some Americans to ban school books on modern science. Most of the Americans who supported these efforts were conservative rural Americans who believed in the traditional ideas of the Protestant Christian Church. Many of them were fearful of the many changes that had taken place in American society. Science became an enemy to many of these traditional religious Americans. Science seemed to challenge the most basic ideas taught in the Bible. The conflict burst into a major public debate in 1925 in a trial over Charles Darwin's idea of evolution.
British scientist Charles Darwin published his books, The Origin of the Species and The Descent of Man, in the 19th century. The books explained Darwin's idea that humans developed over millions of years from apes and other animals. Most Europeans and educated people accepted Darwin's theory by the end of the 19th century. But the book had little effect in rural parts of the United States until the 1920s. William Jennings Bryan led the attack on Darwin's ideas. Bryan was a rural Democrat who ran twice for president. He lost both times. But Bryan remained popular among many traditional Americans. Bryan told his followers that the theory of evolution was evil because it challenged the traditional idea that God created the world in 6 days. He accused scientists of violating God's words in the Bible. Bryan and his supporters called on local school officials to ban the teaching of evolution. Some state legislatures in the more conservative southeastern part of the country passed laws making it a crime to teach evolution theory.
In 1925, a young science teacher in the southern state of Tennessee challenged the state's new teaching law. The teacher, John Scopes, taught Darwin's evolution ideas. Officials arrested Scopes and put him on trial. Some of the nation's greatest lawyers rushed to Tennessee to defend the young teacher. They believed the state had violated his right to free speech. And they thought Tennessee's law against teaching evolution was foolish in a modern scientific society. America's most famous lawyer, Clarence Darrow, became the leader of Scopes' defense team. Bryan and other religious conservatives also rushed to the trial. They supported the right of the state of Tennessee to ban the teaching of evolution. The trial was held in the small town of Dayton, Tennessee. Hundreds of people came to watch. Religious conservatives, free speech supporters, newsmen, and others. The high point of the trial came when Bryan himself sat before the court. Lawyer Clarence Darrow asked Bryan question after question about the Bible and about science. How did Bryan know the Bible is true? Did God really create the earth in a single day? Is a day in the Bible 24 hours, or can it mean a million years?
Bryan answered the questions, but he showed a great lack of knowledge about modern science. The judge found Scopes guilty of breaking the law. But in the battle of ideas, science defeated conservatism. And a higher court later ruled that Scopes was not guilty. The Scopes evolution trial captured the imagination of Americans. The issue was not really whether one young teacher was innocent or guilty of breaking a law. The real question was the struggle for America's spirit between the forces of modern ideas and those of traditional rural conservatism. The trial represented this larger conflict.
American society was changing in many important ways during the early part of the 20th century. It was not yet the world superpower that it would become after World War II. But neither was it a traditional rural society of conservative farmers and clergy. The 1920s were a period of growth, change, and a struggle between the old and new values. Finally, it was on this day, April 20th, 1999, at a high school in Littleton, Colorado, that two teenaged boys armed with guns and bombs killed 12 of their fellow students and a teacher. The two gunmen then shot themselves to death. I'm Christopher Jones Cruz, reporting from VOA Learning English Headquarters in Washington.